funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What role do engineers play in improving living conditions in the world's most troubled places? Consider the importance of safe, sustainable housing, clean water, decent roads, and sanitation services to your own quality of life. Those things exist in communities in part through the work of professional engineers. So what does it take to share the technologies required to build and maintain them with the people who are struggling just to get by? My guests today have given a lot of thought to those questions, and they are working to encourage other engineers to apply their own talents to global poverty. Jeffrey Orsak is dean of the Bobby B. Lyle School of Engineering at SMU. Jeffrey Talley is founding director of the Hunter and Stephanie Hunt Institute for Engineering and Humanity within the Lyle School. Guys, welcome to Think.
Glad to be here.
And I may be one of the first people to say that that whole term for the Institute in broadcast. This is just today that you guys have started.
Actually, it just happened just this moment. So with your announcement, we are officially begun. So for the first time really any place in this country, there will be an institute that is focused on the role that engineering and technology can play in addressing the suffering and needs of the global poor. And we're really thrilled that it bears the name Hunter and Stephanie Hunt.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
You have said, Jeffrey, that what you're doing here requires a radical rethinking of centuries of engineering practice. What do you mean by that?
Well, we've gotten so good in engineering and building roads and buildings, manufacturing facilities. And most of the time that we're designing these, we have in mind those folks who can afford them. So there's this kind of natural engineer-client relationship, and so the client usually has the resources to pay for these, and so we've spent hundreds of years dealing with client needs. What do you do when your client really doesn't have the money to pay? How do you develop technologies that serve their needs? That's a very, very different kind of relationship that the engineer needs to undertake, and so it really will require a radical rethinking of engineering as we understand it to be able to address really the bottom half of the globe.
Jeff, what are your initial goals for the Institute?
Well, I think initially what we want to try to do is first and foremost identify what challenges we're going to tackle first. Things that come to mind are low-cost housing, water availability, the quality of water, those sorts of things that are not only problems within the United States but problems abroad. But there's lots of different folks out there from NGOs to other universities to private and public sector that have identified technologies that provide some partial solutions to those problems. But there's no one place that you can go and find all that. So the first thing that we're going to try to do is pull that together, what we call discovery, where we can have an integrated fashion where people both in the private and public sector can access so we can be informed as to how we go about tackling a specific project in a region of the world. And then once we get to that point, then we'll start identifying specific projects that we would like to implement where we partner our academic community with the private and public sector.
Well, it sounds like a huge challenge will be understanding what you need to say no to.
My guess is the hard part will be, I wouldn't say no, but it'll be where to focus initially in terms of projects. Certainly our intent is to have a local outreach where we'll be active here in Dallas, Fort Worth, but also Texas. But then certainly across the U.S. and abroad. So the key will be is what projects do you tackle first and how do you keep those who don't get the initial nod, yes, we'll do that project, how do we keep them interested so we can eventually get to their type of work?
Typically when universities take on any sort of big initiative like this, it's something that is led by faculty members and researchers who are on the staff, and then students sort of watch by and maybe help as research assistants and graduate students. You're applying Skunkworks methods to this. Can you talk about what that entails?
Well, the Skunkworks has been around for about 60 years and is really the place globally where rapid innovation is done well. And one of the challenges that we face is that we recognize that every day that goes by that we don't provide water or shelter or safety is another day that billions of people suffer on this planet. And so time is a big issue for us, and we want to bring that same kind of operational tempo and passion for change to our students and our partners. And so the Skunkworks provides the ideal mechanism for getting the problem into a prototype, into a solution as quickly as possible. And so in our new facilities where this institute will be housed, the Skunkworks lab will be right below the home for the Hunter and Stephanie Hunt Institute for Engineering and Humanity, and we'll be able to take on challenges and get prototypes out in the field faster than anybody else in the world.
And aside from speed, Skunkworks also implies there's very little hierarchy.
Yeah, everybody's ideas are important, and that's something really key, particularly when you're looking at global poverty, because so many people have dealt with poverty for decades, if not years. And generally speaking, if you go to places which are particularly impoverished, you'll find a lot of creativity there. These communities have somehow adapted to live under these extraordinarily harsh conditions, and they found ways to get access to small amounts of clean water or increase their security. And so we've got to look to the people who have been suffering for some of the earliest answers. And as Jeff was saying, building an international database of the really creative ideas and having those tested and then put into a format where others can use them will be, I think, an extraordinarily useful tool for the global community that's trying to address poverty and the needs of those who are suffering.
What kind of involvement, Jeff, do you expect community stakeholders to have? Because sometimes you and I can look at a problem and say, this is what you need. And you might live in that community and say, actually, what we need is this.
Well, actually, the stakeholders will be critical to implementation of any project, actually in advance of even identifying what project we would pursue. One of the great challenges that engineers have and that Jeffrey alluded to is historically we tend to provide a service or a product to meet a technical demand, but we don't do that in a holistic fashion. So we're going to design or build something for you, but we don't take into account all the times what's the situation on the ground in the community. The idea here is just the opposite, is that for the engineer or scientist to implement the project or service in a disadvantaged community anywhere in the world, you've got to first work with that disadvantaged community and help them help you properly design the service or product that you're going to produce. That way they're involved in it before you actually begin, and that gives you a higher likelihood of the success of the project after the structure itself is complete.
I know that a problem that many very well-intentioned NGOs have dealt with is the fact that they'll come in and put something in place, whether it's wells or sanitation systems or roads or solar units, and then, you know, they walk away after a while, it's all complete, and then things start to break down. Can you talk about how this will address that problem?
Well, you're absolutely right, because we in the West or in the modern world, we tend to think that the solutions that we've developed are going to work no matter where we take them. And so imagine that you took a refrigerator someplace to sub-Saharan Africa and you could find power. How long would that refrigerator operate before it needed some kind of maintenance? Well, who do you call when you were literally thousands of miles away from anybody with any technical expertise? And so as soon as it fails, then it becomes a resource for the community, and they take out parts and bits of it to use for other applications. And so you've got to realize, first things first, is that for this technology to be durable, it has to be repairable and maintainable by the community itself. And so that's one of the keys, is that simple solutions are going to be really key for us. Not only ultra-low cost, but very low maintenance, easily repaired by people with even the most crude knowledge of technology will be a real key. If it gets too sophisticated and it looks too good in the lab, it's probably not going to work in the field, because it's just going to require way too much technology and maintenance to keep it alive. It's just like your computer today. I mean, most of us live in a very modern world today, but as soon as anything goes wrong with a computer, you just yell, you know, get me help. And we've got to avoid those kind of problems happening in these places where there really is no other help. They will have to sustain these kinds of technologies themselves.
What's the balance, Jeff, between technologies that already exist now and can be adapted and things that need to be innovated from the ground up?
Well, there's no short answer to that, because it really depends upon what problem you're focusing on. There are lots of technologies that are pretty innovative that have been developed both in the applied R&D arena, both by the private and public sector. But as Jeffrey just mentioned, the challenge with that many times is how do you make it low cost, and how do you make it where it will be utilized in a disadvantaged community long after the person that introduces the technology is gone? And that's the real struggle we have here. So the beauty of the Institute is it brings together the best and the brightest from the private and public sector, brings them in with academia. Our deliverables are students, graduate students, as well as undergraduates who are helping develop these products, whether it's from an engineering perspective or it could be microfinancing concepts from the business side, and where they pull them all together and actually apply them on the ground. And so I can't give you a short answer that's specific, but it really is going to be project-specific and site-specific. But I think where we're going is to recognize the limitations in the past and try to address those.
What do you both imagine that the challenges and the benefits will be to students who are not accustomed to working in quite this way to apply what they're learning instantaneously?
Well, I think the biggest challenge is going to be trying to get kids who've grown up in the United States out of their comfort zone so they can really put themselves in the place of the folks that they're going to be serving. That this will work best if the student can see themselves not as somebody who's an expert that gets helicoptered in to provide an answer, but more as somebody who shares the plight of the poor in their own way. And so that's a real key for us, is getting kids on the ground around the world so they can see firsthand what these challenges are. The best engineer is the one that you see with the hard hat walking around the project site. If they always stay in the back office, problems pop up, they just are completely incapable of addressing those. And so one of the things that Jeff Talley brings is an immense experience on the ground all over the world that he can then translate to students. And that's something that you just don't see in higher ed very much at all. And so I think once our students see these challenges, they're going to want to respond.
Let's talk a little bit about Jeff's experience, because this is a man sitting before me who was heavily, heavily recruited. What told you, Jeffrey, that he would be the person to do this job?
Well, it was pretty obvious after I had a chance to talk to him that I knew we were going to have a hard time finding somebody that had the intellectual chops to really work at the highest levels of research and at the same time have the ability to go places that no other engineer had ever been in the world. And so when I got a chance to meet Jeff for the first time, I realized this is a person who's got a greater mission in life and that we wanted to take advantage of his skills, but also to provide him with a challenge that really is worthy of his talents. And so it was a great opportunity for me to come across him, because he's a one in a million in the world of higher ed.
And Jeff, you did reconstruction projects.
I've done a lot of reconstruction projects, but I think maybe you're specifically referring to what I was doing in the Middle East last year, where a big part of what I did was to rebuild Baghdad. And I had been asked to be the first provincial engineer for coalition forces in Baghdad, and also had other responsibilities like the counter-IED fight, but I'm sure you're not necessarily interested in that. But the issue there was how can we rebuild Baghdad from a civil environmental engineering perspective, at the same time improve not just conditions for the folks, but bring about stability. So I guess about 6 months before I went over there to assume my role as a provincial engineer and the commander of the engineer force there in Multinational Division Baghdad, was first off, what is the relationship between lack of stability or violence by the various militia groups and engineering? And I don't want to imply it's cause and effect, but what I found after doing about 6 months of analysis on the classified side, looking at violence and the lack of engineering in certain areas, we found there appeared to be a correlation. In those areas where engineering efforts had been, let's say, focused, there seemed to be less violence. And so the whole approach that we took, which turned out to be very successful, was to focus the engineering efforts not in the areas that needed engineering the most, but in the areas where the militia were the strongest and had the strongest foothold. And by doing so, through growth of Iraqi engineering firms, where they would produce the deliverables with us assisting them, you would, so to speak, change the conditions on the ground where the Iraqi people would provide information about where the militia were in their community, and thus take the engineering effects and improve the stability.
Jeff Talley is with us. He is founding director of the Hunter and Stephanie Hunt Institute for Engineering and Humanity. Jeffrey Orsak is dean of the Bobby B. Lyle School of Engineering at SMU. We are talking today about humanitarian engineering. You can join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education, announcing a new 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Jeffrey Orszag, who is Dean of the Bobby B. Lyle of School of Engineering at SMU, and Jeffrey Talley, founding director of the brand new Hunter and Stephanie Hunt Institute for Engineering and Humanity at SMU. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Just want to follow up, Jeff, about what you were talking about earlier with rebuilding Baghdad. It has to be extraordinarily difficult to sort of engineer the peace in a place that is not and won't be for the foreseeable future entirely peaceful, knowing that you could put something in place that will get destroyed again.
Well, you're exactly right, and that's why it's so important before you implement a project to have the stakeholders involved. In this case, it's a local community. So the way that we went about that was you would first identify with the community what was needed to make their lives and their community better. And then you would also, from the same community, employ the local folks to be the main workers for the engineering firm that you might have an Iraqi company form with your guidance. And then so you're promoting economic growth. And then you would link that to local and national government, so you pull the whole thing together. And it's really about, as I used to tell folks when I was in Baghdad, about waving the Iraqi flag and waving that Iraqi people flag as opposed to the United States. But the reasons that folks generally will do things that they wouldn't otherwise do, and that's some of the militia weren't necessarily hard-driven militia in the sense that they believed the ideology that was being put out by the leader of that militia group. They were just trying to survive. And so the thought is if you can take those non-lethal ways of using engineering to really bring about stability and growth in a community in the most violent places in Iraq and in the world, what could you do if you really focused that in other areas? And so that's the whole point.
Do you have any examples offhand of things that took you or your team by surprise, priorities that the Iraqi people had that you wouldn't have thought would be number one on the list?
I wouldn't say the priorities were any different than I would expect. The Iraqi people want the same thing that you and I would want. They want water. They want access to electricity. They want streets that they can travel down. They want economic opportunity. So really, no surprises there. The biggest surprise, though, however, was how quickly things were able to turn around. I would say we focused initially our efforts in Sadr City, which was considered the most desperate and dangerous place within Baghdad and Iraq. And what I was somewhat surprised was after a week or two of effort there, concentrated effort, we already started getting Iraqi people risking their lives to tell us and the Iraqi security forces where the militia were because they could see a different way of living.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. An email here from Chet asks, one of the causes for hunger in Africa is a lack of farm-based storage for crops. Without this storage, food can rot or be sent to market only during harvest time and not receive a good price. Is this an area of interest?
Absolutely. If you look at hunger, one of the biggest challenges, of course, is brought out by this question, is how do you get food moved around the globe? That we do produce a tremendous amount of food all over the world today that gets wasted because we just can't get it moved. And the transportation infrastructure in the emerging countries and economies around the globe is just pathetic. I mean, you've got certain countries in Africa that might have less than 500 miles of paved highway in the entire nation. That's essentially the drive from Dallas to San Antonio over to Houston. And so if you think, okay, we want to bring lots of new food in or we want to bring lots of heavy equipment to assist with farming, there's just no way to do it based on the infrastructure. And so storage is a key issue. That's why housing is so important. I mean, we use our homes to store food for our families so that we don't have to go out three times a day to hunt and gather. And so all of this falls into kind of a systems view of addressing the needs of the global poor. So you have to look at the entire set of infrastructures that are really provided through engineering, transportation, safety, storage. All these things are equally key. And so you leave one of them out, the chain breaks, and you're right back where you were. And that's been part of the problem that the UN has had with their Millennium Project, is that we just aren't getting all of the key elements in place so that there will be a successful solution for a community.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking this afternoon about humanitarian engineering with Jeffrey Orszag, who is Dean of the Bobby B. Lyle School of Engineering, and Jeff Talley, who is founding director of the Hunter and Stephanie Hunt Institute for Engineering and Humanity. Let's go on the phones now to Ronnie in Fort Worth. Hi, Ronnie.
Hi. First of all, I want to applaud your guests, and I think that you guys are fantastic in what you're doing here. But my real question is I guess I'm going to make up a term and call it the pioneer techno. And what I mean by that is I think that sooner or later, across the globe, people are going to go back to living like the pioneers did, in the sense of collecting their own water, handling their own waste, raising their own food. But then the technology side of it would be living in a home where we have today's modern technologies, where there's TV and washing clothes, you know, machines to wash clothing and things like that. And I'm trying to wrap all this into a sustainable living type situation, where again people make their own energy and power and things like that. And I just wonder, how sustainable would that be, and would it be cost effective? And well, how do you guys feel about that?
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Well, I'll take the first crack at it. I think Ronnie makes a very good point that we're starting to see, certainly in the developed world, a move toward providing local environmental solutions right at the home. That doesn't translate so well, though, to the emerging world where you've got these huge urban slums. You can't really collect enough water for the population densities that you see around these major cities, like Mexico City, for example. And so it's going to be a combination. I think in the developed worlds, we'll see new technologies emerge that will lighten our footprint on the globe. But in the emerging world, it's a completely different ballgame. Those kinds of technologies don't translate so universally to the really, really desperate situations. The urban slum problem is one that Jeff Talley faced in Baghdad, and is one that really is the crisis point right now globally, because within these slums, which are growing at such an enormous rate, you find a spread of diseases, you find violence, all kinds of abuses to humanity. And so that's really where we need to focus early and often. The thought of a small village out on the plain somewhere is I think, has its needs, but when you're looking at the billions that are living in and around these large urban areas, that's an area where I think that Jeff Talley's experience is going to be uniquely beneficial, and we'll have to come up with completely different solutions.
Yeah, I think Ronnie's point is well taken, and I certainly agree with him that would be great if we could get there for everyone, not just in the United States but abroad. But as Jeffrey's mentioned, the key is, I think, economic linkage to whatever your technology is. And if you can't provide a linkage to growing the economy, providing business and economic opportunities for the disadvantaged that may be linked to that sustainability, then I think the idea of the sustainability being successful long-term is going to be limited.
Who pays for all this work to get done?
Well, one of the keys for our model is that we create a market for this. And one thing that I think we've realized is that when you go to the pure philanthropy or NGO model, extremely difficult to sustain over the long term. Political whims can change things. But markets have proven to be just remarkably durable. They've been around for centuries, and they've really been the most effective way of getting technologies out into the hands of people. The key, though, here is that the price for these kinds of services and products has to be so low that even the poorest of the poor can afford them in some way, shape, or form. And so with some of the new, really creative financial models that have emerged over the last 10 or 15 years, together with our focus on looking at ultra, ultra low-cost solutions, we'll be able to get these things deployed through kind of market-based approaches.
Are you thinking, when you say new kinds of financing, like Grameen Bank and that
right,
sort of thing?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. We have an email here from James, who is a graduate of the SM School of Engineering and also a current student at Perkins. Very interested in the Institute and wants to know whether or not the Institute is working with the folks at Perkins, which is the theology school.
Sure, it's a great question, and the answer is we're not working with Perkins yet, but that's because today, actually just a few hours ago, was day one. The intent is it's not an engineering-focused institute, as I tried to allude to earlier on. What makes the Institute unique is its engineering and humanity, which means we'll have folks involved not only across campus, but across the globe, both in academia and the private and public sectors that represent all the different disciplines, which certainly would include social sciences or theology-minded, religious-based folks who want to get involved. And the only reason we haven't been able to make those clear linkages with Perkins or any other school yet on campus is because we're now just getting started. But certainly there will be opportunities for faculty and students across all the different departments and schools at SMU and other universities around the world to get involved with the Institute.
We've talked already a little bit this hour about the need for rethinking and redefining what engineering is. Do you think that the misconception that engineers are sort of methodical to a fault and just very task-oriented, is that something that plagues engineers themselves to the same extent that it plagues the general community?
Well, you know, these stereotypes that you alluded to exist because there's some measure of truth to it. But the more I travel and talk to engineers who are frustrated that they've become almost parts of a large machine to produce new innovations rather than kind of to be able to control their own humanity and to feel that they're connected to people is something that I think is really at the heart of what we're trying to do. There is a large army of very bright innovators around the globe who are ready to take on these kinds of challenges. And once we can mobilize them, I think what you will see is this blossoming of ideas from every corner of the world that can help people. And that, I hope, will also change people's perceptions of what engineering is, that it's not just about making gizmos, but it's about really changing people's lives. And once we're able to achieve that, you'll see, I think, a completely different definition for the field going forward in the 21st century.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go next to Audie in Fort Worth. Hi, Audie.
Hello. I had two questions, really. My first question was, I heard earlier that you said the engineer would get out and walk around the job site. And I was wondering, did you feel that, because I'm a tradesman, I'm an iron worker by craft, and I was just wondering, do you feel that when the engineer does interact with the trades that they're engineering for, that makes them a better engineer?
Well, Audie, you make a good point. So often, you know, the engineer shows up in a tie on the site and looks completely different than everybody else who's doing the real labor of the work of the project. We really preach that you've got to be on the ground as much as possible to be an effective engineer, because the engineer is just one part of the continuum of what it takes to put together a large project. And if they see themselves as somehow separate, then all of a sudden the ideas that were on paper don't get translated into steel or brick or concrete. And so the more that engineers can interface not only with the customer but also to those folks who are building the project, the better the project is going to be.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have an email here from Craig who says, I'm wondering how I can be part of what you're doing. I've done several engineering projects and am intrigued with what your team is trying to accomplish.
Well, Craig, we appreciate your interest, and there are ways that you can get involved. The first, and I'll give a shameless plug for our website and our email. The email is enh@lyle.smu.edu. And our webpage is, if you go to the engineering school webpage at SMU, you'll see Engineering and Humanity link there, and you can click on it, and it'll provide our phone number and ways to get in touch. What you should be seeing soon is opportunities for those outside of the Institute to volunteer their time, their talents, their resources to help us, whether it's private companies or, well, it's individuals. And we should have that launched probably within another couple weeks. And the idea would be, if you're a company, you could click on there. And I've already had a lot of companies calling me because they have kind of heard about the Institute before it was publicly announced. So they would provide a white paper, if you will, on how their company wanted to participate in a certain type of project in a certain type part of the world where maybe they're already actively engaged. We've had other individuals that just have a specific interest. So what we'll be trying to do is collect those interested parties and get them matched to the right project based upon their skill set. So we appreciate your interest. And I would just say, if you could just be patient with us and give us a little bit of time to get that up on the web so we could handle what we think will be just literally huge volumes of interest, that would be great. Thanks.
It's a nice problem to have, actually. Overwhelming interest. We have an email here from Ron in Dallas who asks, how could this concept be used to reduce poverty, violence, and illiteracy in the urban slums of the United States?
Well, it translates irrespective of the culture. I mean, there's poverty here in the U.S. just like there is in sub-Saharan Africa and South America and Southeast Asia. And all of it is relative to scale. So what we're really trying to do is to provide the environments where people have hope. And once they've got hope, then they begin to access higher levels of services like education, healthcare. Once they get education, then they're in the market at a higher value. And then they can begin to grow families where there's upward mobility. That That entire chain really does begin, though, with providing that physical environment where people feel safe, people feel like they can be healthy, and feel like, as I mentioned before, like there's some hope. And so that's one of the things that we want to do, is to not just simply look overseas, but we have to be able to take care of our backyard as well. It provides a fantastic laboratory for new ideas, both that we generate and also those that our friends and colleagues generate. So we look forward to being able to work right here in Dallas and across the state and the nation.
How important is it to you that you use local materials in making all this happen, so that things are pretty sustainable and can, in fact, be scaled in the future, even maybe after you pull out of a specific area?
Well, I think anywhere you implement a project, you have to use local labor. You have to use local materials to the extent possible. One is, it's just because it makes it easier to get the work done. But secondly, again, one of the challenges historically with engineers, and I'll include myself in that group, is we'll go somewhere and we'll implement a project, and we, you know, the first thing you do is you bring in materials and labor all from outside the user community or those local stakeholders. And what you've done there is you've focused on the product being the building or the infrastructure or whatever it is you're producing. In reality, the ultimate deliverable are the people that live in the community. And so if you don't integrate the labor and the materials locally to the extent possible, you're not going to have that holistic success to what the desired endpoint is, which is to bring about economic prosperity and opportunity for those people in the community through engineering services.
That is a double challenge, though, because you have to learn how to use materials that maybe you weren't trained about when you were in school.
It absolutely is a challenge. I mean, I think back in Solder City, I had to put in the contracts that we hired only 16 to 30-year-old males because they were being paid more money to work to put out bombs. And so the idea was to get them to a different trade and pay them better to do it.
My guests are Jeff Talley, founding director of the Hunter and Stephanie Hunt Institute for Engineering and Humanity, and Jeffrey Orsek, dean of the Bobby B. Lyle School of Engineering at SMU. We'll resume the conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a new 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking today about humanitarian engineering with Jeffrey Orsak, who is dean of the Bobby B. Lyle School of Engineering at SMU, and Jeff Talley, founding director of the Hunter and Stephanie Hunt Institute for Engineering and Humanity at SMU. If you want to join the conversation, send an email to think@kera.org or call us at 1-800-933-5372. We've talked a lot so far about innovation and the importance of that, and it's no small thing that you are, in fact, innovating a different kind of engineering education here. Is there a model for what you're trying to do?
Chris, as we know of, there is no model out there anywhere in the world that's taking the approach that we are to generating new engineers. Because the idea is that they have to meet all of the traditional academic requirements of that engineering or technical degree. So let's say we're a graduate student and we're working on our master's thesis or a capstone project or even a PhD with a dissertation that's very technical. They still have to do all that. They still have to get the publications. They still have to be new and novel in the world in terms of academia. But unlike any other degree, they now have to take that work and demonstrate it on the ground in a disadvantaged community with a project that's approved by the institute. They have to do both to get the degree, which allows them to take what we call engaged scholarship. They take the academia, if you will, or the learning, and they link that to leadership and service, and they pull it all together in a new sort of way that we don't believe anywhere else right now is actually executing that type of approach.
business students and law students and medical students and journalism students are typically required to take an ethics class that that relates specifically to what they're studying. Is that the case for engineering students typically?
Yeah. In fact, actually, as part of our professional certification, you have to have taken ethics courses and then maintain ethics curricula throughout your whole career. So it's a really core element of what makes an engineer a great engineer. And it's just been part of our history and culture for hundreds of years.
I want to talk for a minute about, we mentioned earlier using local materials and trying to find local tradespeople. Are you also thinking about working with local engineers who might exist on the ground in some of these even developing countries?
In every case, it will be yes, because you won't have any, you'll have a very low likelihood of success. Again, success being defined as changing the community, not just producing an engineering product. So if you don't get the locals involved, and I don't just mean the people, but the local professionals, if they exist, you have a very slim chance of success. So we will be bringing in local business people from all aspects of life, engineering, science, regulators, as well as microfinancing, all those sorts of things wherever we work to give to not only bring the benefit to the people, but benefit to the economic growth of the local businesses.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Terry in Dallas. Hello, Terry.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Hi. I just had a comment about using local materials and local engineers, local talent, shall we say. And that is, I work in the maintenance end of an engineering end product, and I'm just thinking maintenance always, okay? So if a person uses local materials, local people who have been on the project, then that contributes to the maintainability of the project afterwards once it's built.
That's a great point. Thanks so much for calling.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I think Terry really hits a very, very important point here. It's one thing where you can develop a new project and bring all the ministers from the country in to have photo op. It's another to be able to come back a year or two later and see that that project has really changed that entire community. And maintenance is very, very key there, and that's one of the challenges when you go into the emerging world is that the lack of education in those communities means you have fewer and fewer people who can actually maintain technologies, even as simple as roads, which, as we know, we drive around Dallas and these roads have potholes. Imagine if we can't maintain roads, what it must be like if you go someplace where there's really almost no infrastructure whatsoever. So this is a big issue for us, and it's one that we're going to have to address to be really successful over the long term.
What sort of training and education will you provide to people who are going to be doing this work with regard to dealing with the bureaucracy that exists on the ground wherever it is that you are trying to work?
Well, every project that we'll have will have to have a project leader or project manager, if you will, and that will generally be a local person that's on the ground that's familiar with not only the local business practices but also the government communities that may or may not exist in the area. That's going to be critical to every project we do, whether it's in South Dallas or whether it's somewhere else in the U.S. or whether it's in the Africa where we're focusing on a water quality and quantity issue. We won't be able to identify those folks until we really get the scope of work identified for what we're actually going to try to accomplish at a specific location. But that'll be key to us taking, again, that scholarship from the student perspective and engaging that onto the ground itself.
Do you have even a nebulous idea of what you might undertake locally?
Here in Dallas,
yeah.
North Texas. Well, we're looking right now at housing as one of the kind of the key issues because, as everyone knows, housing prices have continued to grow over the last 3-4 decades. It's one of the unique technologies that exists that has actually gotten more expensive over time rather than most technologies, which gets cheaper over time. As you know, your computer gets cheaper each year and is better. Homes, though, are not better each year, and they tend to be more expensive. So it's one of those curves that we want to attack so that more people can get into home ownership that will provide them with all sorts of upper mobility. And so that's a real key. And we've had some fantastic conversations already with local organizations that are very, very interested and active in this area already. But we want to really push the envelope as hard as we can in terms of technologies and innovation to be able to look at really radical new ways of doing construction practices so that one day you might be able to assume that everyone can own a home no matter what their income is. That's got to be a goal for us, is to be able to provide those kinds of technologies at a price that everyone can afford.
Jeff, there's been some reporting done that you initially were resistant to leaving. You were very happy at Notre Dame. Can you tell us a little bit about how you were sort of talked into taking this on?
I will, yes. I know I'm familiar with the article that you're referring to. A lot of people have apparently read that article here in Dallas. I think the short answer is I was pretty happy as a professor at Notre Dame and grateful for the opportunities I would have to leave Notre Dame and go off and help the armed forces, particularly in the Middle East. But what convinced me to leave Notre Dame and come down here to Dallas, Fort Worth, and specifically SMU was the Institute. There were other opportunities that the university offered me, a chair of a department, certainly to continue being a professor of civil and environmental engineering. Those are great. And a chair or professorship was actually endowed for me in the area of leadership and global entrepreneurship. And those are all great and wonderful things, and I'm appreciative. But at the end of the day, it was an opportunity with this institute where I could take those things that I've thought long and hard about for many years, that I've actually been able to implement in some way or fashion overseas, and now we could take this, pull it together, and really take it out and see what it can do globally. And that's what excited me, and that's what got me here.
Are you still in the reserves?
I am. I'm still an active serving Major General in the U.S. Army Reserves, and I command the 84th Training Command at Fort Knox, Kentucky. So SMU is very generous in sharing my time with the Army. And on any given day, I think they want me all to themselves, and the Army also would like me to probably pretty much quit SMU and work full-time for them. So I'm grateful that both parties are sharing at this point.
Any inkling of whether you'll be redeployed at any time in the near future?
Well, I think every soldier, trains and makes sure that they're ready for themselves and for their units to deploy whenever asked to do so. And so certainly that possibility always does exist. I'd say, at my age and at my rank, that the likelihood gets less the higher up you get. But there's always a possibility. You know, I was asked to perhaps go do some things in Afghanistan in engineering when I left Baghdad this last time and chose. It was truly a volunteer question, and I said no because I wanted to return to the university and to my students. And so I think I'll be here for a while, as long as SMU and the Dallas community will have me.
Jeffrey, how does that sort of sharing work? I would imagine that although it would be a sacrifice at the times that Jeff's gone, there's also benefits to be gained in the program due to that experience.
Yeah, I think it's such a huge win-win for both. Having him with current, up-to-date, real-life experiences from all over the globe is so important to our students. When he talks about what the world looks like, he's referring to right now, not out of some book, not out of a news report. I mean, he has lived what most of us only see on TV, and so that is so powerful for motivating kids, and it's something that I think makes him extraordinarily important to higher education and education in general, and we're just thrilled that he's here at SMU, and he's also able to continue his work with the U.S. Army.
Will it be a requirement that undergraduates and graduate students who are working within this program travel overseas and work specifically in other places?
It depends on where the project is. Certainly, if your project is overseas, then you're a no-go at Station 1 if you can't travel overseas. But the short answer is no, because let's say that we have folks from the local community that are working professionals that want to pursue a master's degree or even the doctorate in engineering for humanity, or they have a business background and they're going to pursue a master's degree with a capstone project. Obviously, it's not practical for them to be able to work on a project in Africa or in Central South America. There'll be local projects that they'll be able to participate in, ones that will allow them to contribute and meet the requirements of the Engaged Scholarship that I alluded to earlier, without requiring them to travel abroad.
But I will add, though, that there's a very high interest among engineering students at all ages to be able to go and work around the globe. We sent a team down to Mexico to a small fishing village called Las Malvinas that had existed largely off of salt water for hundreds of years, down to work with that community to see if we could find ways to provide them with fresh water. And it was an extremely moving experience for our students, so much so that the entire village came out and prayed over this small delegation of engineering students that they would be successful because they had lived generation after generation really consuming only foul water or salt water as their primary source of fluid intake. And these kids came back really recognizing how important their role will be going forward in the future. So it not only – those communities really give us more than we give them, and I think that is so true this time of year to remember that giving and being selfless is one of the greatest gifts that you can give yourself, and we're trying to provide that for our own engineering students.
And we're going to have no shortage of students, I assure you. I already have my phone and emails already ringing, so to speak, with students that have kind of heard about this and they want to get involved. And as Jeffrey's mentioned, most of the students, of course, want to be full-time graduate students and engage globally. And that's not just engineers. Those are in other fields as well. And so I don't think we're going to have any shortage of interested applicants that want to try to see if they meet the bar, so to speak, to enter this new program.
Any challenges to getting the faculty, which has been entrenched in sort of the more traditional way of thinking about engineering, on board with all this?
Well, this has been a long process for us. We've been at this for a couple of years. And so one of the great things about being a faculty is you get to focus on the things that you love to do most. And so those that really are dedicated to this kind of work are going to be drawn to it, and will be working very closely with Jeff and his entire team. And those that prefer to do other things will have the luxury of doing that. So we really haven't seen any kind of issue other than, thank goodness, that we're the place that has really tried to change engineering and to bring this notion of humanity into engineering in a really complete way. And there's going to be a lot of enthusiasm all around. And I hope Dallas is proud that this is where this all began.
I would say, just to comment on what Jeffrey just said, is that just the opposite. I think this is going to be a huge recruiting tool. I'll just be frank, how we can steal very well-established faculty from outstanding universities to come to SMU and Dallas-Fort Worth, because in the Institute, it'll engage your head and your heart.
Do either of you have a timetable in mind? And since you're both very interested in speed, I imagine you do. Between now, day one, when you're in the planning stages, and the time that you feel that you're fully up and running and doing what you wanted to do?
I think I would be dishonest if I said yes. I have some goals and objectives that I'm not ready to share just yet, because as I tell folks, if your ideas or your thoughts aren't resources, just intellectual dialogue. And so what we're trying to do now is get those resources linked with the goals and objectives of the Institute, so we can go after that first project, go after those first group of students. I certainly would think it's very reasonable to expect that we would have students entering this new program in the fall of 2010, and that we would be starting to implement some projects, at least in a cursory way, perhaps as early as this coming summer.
Jeffrey, we just have about 20 seconds left. How important is it to create a culture where it's okay to take risks?
Oh, that's what it's all about. Innovation is based on someone's willingness to accept risk and to accept failure. And without that, we will just stay where we are. So this is a big part of our future.
Jeffrey Orsak is dean of the Bobby B. Lyle School of Engineering at SMU. Jeff Talley is founding director of the Hunter and Stephanie Hunt Institute for Engineering and Humanity within the Lyle School. Guys, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. It's been great.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.